Okay, we are back and returning to the idea of broadcast search. So this is basically an understanding of firms as interacting with independent individuals, not other firms. And instead of markets being the mechanism through which solutions are identified, the metaphorical mechanism in broadcast search is really contests, which is a market of sorts, but one that's competitive in a very particular way, as we'll see. You're also not looking for technologies that may or may not exist. You're looking to get people to solve a problem for you. Right? Let's start with the definition that Jeppesen and Lacani, the authors of this particular piece, let's start with the way that they define broadcast search. As they define it, broadcast search is a problem-solving process involving, and I quote, disclosing the details of the problem at hand and inviting the participation of anyone who deems themselves qualified to solve the problem. Upon learning of the existence of the problem, solvers will self-select to attempt to create a solution and are rewarded for their efforts if they are successful. This is also sometimes related, end quote, by the way. This is also what sometimes gets talked about as crowdsourcing, in the sense that you broadcast a problem to a crowd of potential problem solvers, and then the vision is for them to start solving the problem if they think they can. Or, as is often the case, if they think they can learn something from trying. Right? People generally participate in these contests for various reasons that we can discuss in class. As was the case with markets for technology, broadcast search by other names also has kind of a long history. Jeppesen and Lacani mentioned the Longitude Prize, but there are many others, right? And you can, by the way, read about the story in greater detail in the novels in the Baroque Cycle by Neal Stephenson that that Karim Lacani often refers to as he's talking about this, right? Something like architectural contests are also a kind of crowdsourcing that goes back, I would imagine, thousands of years. Before there was TripAdvisor, there were guidebooks, and they are kind of crowdsourcing that are in the sense that travel writers would often be sent information by travelers contributing updates on various things to their guidebooks. And more recently, the company that discovered, or rather developed, LSD kind of crowdsourced the uses for the drug, probably with pretty interesting results in the 40s. And today, driven especially by the ability afforded by the internet to reach people across the world at very low cost, there are tons of examples of this happening. Procter & Gamble is a big user. Lego is also a pretty famous one, and you can basically Google your way to a ton of other examples. As I mentioned at the opening, individuals are basically recognizing new ways of using this organizational technology in ever more ways as it gets progressively better understood and climbs up its S-curve. And so the question is, of course, where the Fosterian limit to the technology is, and research is kind of split on that. A lot of researchers think that it is and will continue to be a niche. Others think that we're only seeing the beginning of a transformation of innovation management practices. Certainly the kind of results that especially Karim Lacani, author of this paper, has been producing in his crowd innovation lab at Harvard Business School is really encouraging of the latter view, namely that this is something which is just going to beat the pants off of every other innovation management technique out there. I kind of encourage you to check it out. There's a nice YouTube video called The Crowd as an Innovation Partner that gives kind of a good overview of some of the developments in this area, and especially the role that his lab has played in it. This particular paper on marginality and problem-solving effectiveness in broadcast search was one of the early studies kind of showing the value of broadcast search in a non-anecdotal manner. As you can kind of imagine from the examples above, there's a lot of anecdote and lots of trumpeting of single cases. But essentially what we see is, in this paper, is two things, right? The broadcast search is effective right? That's clear. Joy's law seems to hold up. And that's kind of the trivial part of the argument, really. And the second part is that marginality is an important driver of broadcast search's effectiveness. And that's marginality in both a technical and a social sense. So to study the effectiveness of broadcast search, the authors are going to look at InnoCentive. Right? So they detail the history of this platform a little bit, but the essential image to have in your mind is of a company, InnoCentive, that organizes problem-solving contests online. Right? So the platform offers companies the opportunity to publish a contest with them, which means taking a problem that the company has, framing it in a way that makes it amenable to being solved by people with many different backgrounds, right? So it might, for instance, take a chemistry problem and turn it into a computational problem such that the problem is not limited. I'm sorry about that. Somebody came wading into my office. So basically, we were talking about taking a problem, say a chemistry problem, and turning it into a computational problem such that the problem is not limited to being solvable by chemists, right? That's kind of a big part, it's going to turn out, of why this works, right? Another part of what InnoCentive does is they basically set up or fix a price that seems, I think, to be, typically be in the range of $25,000, which, as Karim Lakhani sometimes says, is like decimal dust in the R&D context. That's like nothing, right? And it also means fixing a quantitative set of criteria for judging the winning solution. It also means, and I think this is tremendously important and often underappreciated, it means publishing the problem to a group of potential solvers that InnoCentive has invested in getting to sign up and cultivated as a distinct community of potential solvers, right? There are about 80,000 solvers on their platform, and they participate in different competitions. They build up scores over time from the different projects that they work on, and they stay on the platform because they keep getting interesting problems and because they can kind of learn skills there, right? So this is not just about blind broadcasting in the sense that any old firm just kind of throws a problem on its website. No, it's about broadcasting to an open but also very cultivated group of solvers, right? And so this is a company, InnoCentive in this case, that has demonstrably been good at the non-trivial task of translating problems into a form that's good for broadcasting and that's capable of getting motivated eyeballs onto those problems, right? So that's kind of a caveat of getting this to work, right? You kind of need that. You need that setup to work. What Jeppesen and Lakhani do then is to look at what happens in 166 of these contests. These are 166 scientific problems, so they're not R&D problems, but they're like R&D, or they're scientific problems as in the sense of something that's gets done by scientific labs, right? What then happens to those 166 problems is that 15,000 individuals read the problem formulations, and about 1,000 people contribute solutions. Of those 166, about 50 problems get solved, with about 60 solvers getting 75 prizes, right? So there's lots and lots of attrition here, as you'd expect from broadcasting. And this, of course, means that you have to have a lot of motivated solvers ready to go at the outset, right? If you need 15,000 people to get 50 solutions, you can kind of see why it's not trivial to get a lot of people on this platform and to cultivate that they're the right people, right? Also, obviously, not every problem finds a solution. And so just to get a sense of the average competition, you can kind of imagine that the average competition has about 250 people reading the problem and 10 of them submitting solutions, right? And in 70% of the competitions, that's one person winning. Otherwise, it's two. And about 90% of the winners only win once, right? So it's only one time that they really have that winning insight or winning solution. 8% win twice. About 10% of the contributors are women. And in other words, These are pretty small competitions, and there are many different winners in very niche problems. That should kind of set your expectations a little bit. We're not talking about a total online free-for-all here. We're talking about pretty pretty small competitive sets. And then the authors basically use the data that InnoCentive has on solvers and problems, and they send a survey to about 1,000 contest participants, and then they do this pretty sophisticated two-stage analysis, first to determine which of the 15,000 problem readers submit solutions, and second, which of the 1,000 problem submitters, of the 1,000 solution submitters become winners, right? So there's nothing particularly surprising about how they go about this, including their measure of technical marginality. I think it says something pretty depressing about science, that you can viably measure social marginality through a gender variable, right? That you are actually socially marginal if you're a woman. That has a lot of unfortunate truth to it. Hopefully not too many years, this won't be a viable research design. I hope that. Nonetheless, what we're interested in is how technical and social marginality shape the decision to enter the contest and the chance to win it once you've entered. So what do they see? Being more marginal, both in a technical and social sense, makes you less likely to enter a contest, right, as measured by submitting a solution. People may be working on a solution without submitting it and self-selecting out of submission, of course. But being marginal makes you less likely to show up for the competition. The interesting finding then is that the marginal solvers who do show up are more likely to win those competitions that they enter, right? Both when technical distance is high between the problem and the solvers, i.e. when people come from fields that are different from the problem, and when they're women, solvers that are highly marginal are more likely to win. So basically, what does that mean? Let's start with the technological distance story first. This suggests that broadcast search works because there will be viable ways to solve a problem outside of the field in which it originates. The authors give kind of a nice example of this when they talk about a toxicology problem being solved with somebody by somebody with a PhD in protein crystallography using ideas that were common in that field. A famous example that's like famous in the sense of famous in the research community is one example that's not in this particular research, but in the book chapter Open Innovation and Organizational Boundaries by Karim Lakhani, Hila Livsitz-Assaf, and Michael Tushman. That's of NASA trying to improve an algorithm for predicting solar flares and receiving a winning solution from a retired telecommunications engineer in Vermont who has a cat. And the intuitive way to think about this, basically, is that the siloization of scientific problems is fundamentally problematic, right? Given, of course, that we're dealing with a pretty selected sample of problems here. Nonetheless, this is one of those instances where you could viably argue that specialization in scientific problem solving is limiting progress and some kind of effective mechanism for exploring alternative knowledge domains, like broadcast search, is going to be hugely valuable because people are essentially sitting in their own discipline's ivory tower and never looking beyond the discipline for inspiration. Right. The social marginality issue tells us something of the same thing, but with a more depressing tone. Much like how disciplines monopolize problems, by, in the absence of broadcast search at least, only granting members of their own knowledge domain access to their ivory tower and its problems, there are also guardians at the door to the ivory tower, keeping minorities out. And that, of course, is just super depressing, especially given the ideals of what the Republic of Science and society in general ought to be. What is encouraging, though, is that something like broadcast search, simply by virtue of being more efficient than closed models, may crowd out closed models, and in that sense make society more socially blind, which is super encouraging. Now, a big part of the explanation for the effectiveness of broadcast search is that solutions oftentimes actually already exist. They don't have to get invented. They're simply too marginal to get leveraged in the typical closed innovation model. Right? Some 70% of the solutions were partially or fully based on solutions developed previously. So solutions are in this regard underutilized, much like general purpose technologies actually. And what broadcast search does is it matches solutions to problems. Not always, but sometimes. Rather than making people solve problems from scratch. That's kind of similar to how Shane's Austrian Entrepreneur identifies opportunities, and it's similar to how Augstorfer's Bootlegger is kind of searching for a problem to which he or she can apply a solution that has been developed. Another big part of the explanation for why broadcast search works more generally is a matter of relatively basic statistics, right? It doesn't get mentioned in this particular paper, but it appears in lots of Karim Lakhani's other work, and it gets described in the video that I mentioned before, right? Now, you can think of the quality of solutions as a normally distributed thing, right? It follows a bell curve pattern. If you compare closed innovation, where you have some set of within-discipline experts trying to solve a particular problem, and broadcast search, where you have a self-selected mixture of solvers, the average quality is going to be higher in the closed model, right? But when an open model works, it's when you have variance in the broadcast search solvers that is sufficiently high, right? That means that the tail of the distribution are going to be fatter with broadcast search, such that the probability of finding an extreme high-value solution is higher. And of course, what you're interested in innovation is often not the average value of ideas. You're interested in the best idea, especially in problems like the ones we see here in this particular empirical case. So what you want, therefore, is a sufficiently large number of solvers contributing solutions to have that full distribution come through and for those high-value solutions to show up, right? They don't show up without adequate numbers, necessarily, right? So broadcast search works because you get enough contributions such that, popularly put, the whole world can contribute, because it's often about having the requisite knowledge already. Somebody will know exactly how to approach this, so it's a matter of getting so many people in the door as to ensure that that special someone does show up, right? The general person that shows up will not have a better solution than what can be developed within discipline. But when you have sufficiently many people showing up, you can get that full distribution pulling through. Basically, for someone, somewhere, it won't be a question of solving a problem. It'll be a question of applying knowledge that already exists. Right. The downside of that is, of course, that more participants make solvers less likely to win individually. So there's going to be kind of a matter of striking the appropriate balance between how many get involved. Right? There are things you can do to manage that, such as creating sub-competitions or other devices, and the nature of the problem also shapes what you want. Also, of course, the whole world does not always want to contribute to any given problem, and that's why I made a bit of a fuss talking about why this is a study of incentive rather than broadcast search in general. Having a branded platform to shepherd problems to potential solvers is going to matter a lot. And certain organizations are going to have an easier time than others attracting external contributions. NASA, for instance, has done a lot of work broadcasting solutions, and they just attract this incredible amount of attention in a way that a company developing, I don't know, high-tech shoelaces probably won't. So what's going to caveat this otherwise fascinating approach to opening innovation is that the nature of the company and its public recognition is probably going to matter quite a lot. As you think about broadcast search in the general sense, there are a couple of interesting things to note besides this need for an interested audience. Where for markets for technology, the key parameter was the ability to identify valuable external solutions and translate them into firm-specific applications. The challenge in broadcast search is going to be a very different one. It's about turning problems that have already been worked on into a format where others can work on them. And so that problem formulation is going to be essential, as is the ability to somehow select the best solutions, right? If you can't specify performance criteria, it's going to be about judgment and bandwidth to find out what's qualitatively best. And that can be a very difficult problem when you're dealing with these kind of very complex solutions sometimes. And with that, we will leave broadcast search for now, and we'll turn to the idea of free innovation.